So good evening, Bodhisattvas. From where I was sitting, it looked like a really good day from talking to everybody in the room. I hope that everybody did have a good day. So you can tell what my day job is because I have handouts. If you were at lunch today, these are just the same pages that we passed around. But if you don't have one, please take one. There are three of them. We're going to kind of do a little experiment with them. There may not be enough for the third one. I think you might have to look on them. So.
I think everybody has them.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so here's the second one. Do you guys who came in from outside have them also?
They already have
them. Okay, then let's not worry about it. All right, terrific. Okay, thank you. So I'm going to talk tonight just a little bit about refuge and a little more about the precepts. And my hope is that the talk will be shorter than the last couple, though we'll see how that goes. Because I very much want to throw it open to other people to contribute. There are lots of people here who've taken refuge, several of us together in our tradition, others at other times in our tradition, and many of the rest of you from other traditions or traditions that are linked with ours a generation back. And I should also say that my only experience with refuge and the precepts was as a student going through with some of you. I haven't led a refuge ceremony yet, and I haven't worked with people on the precepts. So that's one reason I want to throw things open. And I should also say that for those of you who know Joan's teaching pretty well, you'll probably hear more echoes of some of the stuff that Joan said tonight than even in the last couple talks, though. Again, you know, the views represented here are not necessarily those of the management. And if there's, if there's anything I say wrong, she didn't say it. So the tradition in our school anyway is that the last talk has something to do in a way from turning from that motion of turning the light inward, as Hockman says, back outward toward where we're headed after the retreat, which in some sense, of course, is where we always already are, but not in every sense. So in that context, talking about taking refuge may seem kind of surprising because refuge seems like a shelter or a turning inward. The beginning of our refuge ceremony, though, says, I take refuge in awakening, I take refuge in the way, and I take refuge in my companions. And so as we said a lot in our precepts group, there's a great emphasis not on taking refuge from, but on taking refuge in, paradoxically. And if you think that awakening is going on everywhere all the time, that the way is everything that is, and that your companions are not only in this room, it may become pretty clear that taking refuge is a way of asking about not only your relation to Zen practice or Dharma practice, but to the rest of your life and the rest of the world. So much for refuge. I want to talk now about the precepts. We're going to start with a kind of gambit. It seemed important to me, and I talked with Martha about it, and it made some sense to her, that you actually have some of the words in your mouth. So there's a couple things that will be going on. So we'll start with just the refuge vows. And then, since I didn't want to take time to do all of them, we'll go through about six of the more extended readings of six of the 10 grave precepts, or the 10 bodhisattva vows. And so let me say just a little bit about how that works and some of what I have in mind. So in our ceremony anyway, for each one of those, everybody would repeat or say together what the vow is. After that, we read something supposedly said by, but anyway, attributed to the 5th century ancestor Bodhidharma, who brought Chan meditation to China. And then after that, it says something like, all read individual vows, which I didn't delete, but we're not going to all read our individual vows. But in our ceremony, at that point, if we were actually taking refuge, each person would have written their own response to each one of the precepts, and that person would read those. And then after that, there's something from Dogen, the 13th century founder of Japanese Soto Zen, and we read those together. So I'm hoping that the feel of the words in your mouth do something that maybe just listening to somebody else say them would not. And also I'm interested in, especially the Dogen, there, you know, as you might expect from Zen, for precepts, you know, conduct rules, what Dogen has to say is, by some standards, a little strange. So I want you to, you know, get a feel for that strangeness. Oh, one other thing. So this is a ceremony, and in ordinary language philosophy, there's something called the distinction between use and mention. So if you're uncomfortable saying vows that you don't think you're really taking, you could look at it in that regard. So if it's use, then you really say it. But if I say, oh, Joe said yesterday, since he was a minister, I now pronounce you man and wife, I'm not marrying you. I'm mentioning, you know, I'm quoting it or mentioning it. So again, if you want to, if you've taken refuge and you want to sort of repeat them in that spirit, that's fine. If you haven't and you'd like to say them in that spirit anyway, that's fine. And if they feel like sort of strange words from somebody else, to just sort of quote them. And if you don't want to play, you don't have to play. But I thought it might be a good thing to do. So Martha, do you want to sort of cue what we're going to do and tell them?
Yeah. So did you want to read the vows without the Dogen and Bodhidharma first?
Yeah, I think so, because that's all of them. And you can decide where you do the bell and just tell us what you're going to do. And then after that, if we go to the next two pages where, again, since I don't want to do all of them, I picked, I think, six that seem kind of, not that we'll spend time talking about each of them, but they seemed interesting to say and hear and listen to the kind of torqued quality of them. So
yeah, we'll just go through the vows,
yeah.
And then I'll ring after the different sections.
Yeah. Thank you.
The three refuge vows.
I take refuge in awakening.
I take refuge in the way.
I take refuge in my companions.
The three pure vows.
I vow to do no harm. I vow to do good. I vow to do good for others.
The ten bodhisattva vows.
I vow not to kill. I vow not to steal. I vow not to misuse sex. I vow not to lie. I vow not to misuse drugs. I vow not to gossip maliciously. I vow not to praise myself at the expense of others. I vow not to be stingy. I vow not to indulge in anger. I vow not to disparage awakening, the way, or my companions.
So, as we go through this, we're just going to skip where it starts saying participants read individual vows, we'll just skip that sentence. The ten bodhisattva vows.
I vow not to steal. The way things are is mysterious and hard to see. In a world where the Dharma is unattainable, not having thoughts about gain is called the vow of not stealing. Just as they are, you and the things of the world are one. The gate to freedom is open. I vow not to lie. The way things are is mysterious and hard to see. In a world where the Dharma is inexplicable, not preaching a single word is called the vow of not lying. The Dharma wheel turns from the beginning. There is never too much or too little. Everything is wet with dew, and the truth is ready to harvest. I vow not to praise myself at the expense of others. The way things are is mysterious and hard to see. In a world of the Dharma of equals, not insisting on I and you is called the vow of not praising yourself at the expense of others. Buddhas and ancestors realize the vast sky and the great earth when they appear in their noble body. Their vastness has no inside or outside. When they appear in their true body, there is not even a bit of earth on the ground. Vow not to be stingy. The way things are is mysterious and hard to see. In a world where the Dharma is everywhere, not holding back resources is called the vow of not being stingy. A phrase, a verse, that is everything, each blade of grass. This way, this realization, that is all the Buddhas and ancestors. From the beginning, there has been no stinginess at all. I vow not to indulge in anger. The way things are is mysterious and hard to see. In a world where the Dharma is selfless, not contriving reality for yourself is called the vow of not indulging in anger. Not attacking, not withdrawing, not real or unreal. There is an ocean of bright clouds. There is an ocean of solemn clouds. Vow not to disparage awakening, the way, or my companions. The way things are is mysterious and hard to see. In a world where the Dharma is one, not holding dualistic concepts about ordinary beings and awakening beings is called the vow of not disparaging these three treasures. Your expression of the actual body is the harder and the weirder. This is the most important thing in the world. Its power comes from the ocean of essential nature.
It is beyond explanation. We just accept it with respect and gratitude. Thank you. So trust those Zen guys to make it a little strange. It's really odd, you know, to read that and think that, and wonderful, this is what's happened to a set of precepts for moral conduct. And so I want to talk a little bit tonight about how we work with the precepts in that kind of spirit. So I'm going to use Dan Margolis as a straight man, because he used himself as one. We came together after meeting in various refuge groups for the refuge ceremony. And one session at the retreat, this was back in 2008, we were talking about them really frankly, and we got to I Vow Not to Steal, and Dan just said, well, you know, I don't get this. And he said, I don't take other people's stuff, you know. So it's like, what does it have to do with me? And so immediately everybody was sort of being helpful and saying you had to sort of look inward and in what sense did you steal from others and so on. So there really is, you know, it's not metaphorical exactly, but you need to look at your own inner life and what's going on there and not just what happens in your conduct. And I'll tell you, for me, a couple of the ones that really turned around at that moment. One was, I vow not to gossip maliciously. And another was, I vow not to praise myself at the expense of others. And then maybe a little bit more less spectacularly, but still, I vow not to be stingy. And I thought, I really don't spend a lot of time gossiping about other people. And when I do, it's not usually too malicious. And I don't talk about how great I am. But and then I started as we all did, sort of, you know, looking at what was going on in our own heads, you know, and it's, whoa, you know, there's all this stuff in there. It's just endlessly, you know, so I'm an endless gossip. A lot of it's malicious, you know, I praise myself at the expense of others. I have stingy impulses all the time and so on. And so that turning inward is a kind of Cohen move that we make with the precepts. We take them up in relation to a kind of Cohen spirit of inquiry with a kind of spirit of generosity and curiosity, and we look inside to see what we can find in our own heart minds. So that's the kind of Zen move. And I wasn't alone in feeling, I think Joan said this too, that, and I think each of us sort of reported this really tentatively at our first phone conversation, it's like, actually, it's pretty bad in there, you know, for me, you know. Everybody said, well, me too. And John said it's really the universal experience of working with the precepts that you get that sense of the shakiness. I think what's particularly the object of this, note that, for example, it says, I vow not to indulge in anger and not I vow never to get angry. So I think we're talking not about sort of righteous anger when somebody does something really terrible in the world or something obviously terrible and destructive toward you, but the sort of habitual kind of cranky reactions that are there almost as a kind of default response. John Terrence said once that he could tell the difference because if he yelled at one of his kids, that sometimes the kid would look actually like it was merited, and sometimes the kid would look at him like, what the fuck is wrong with you? You know, why did you do that? So one of the things I think working with precepts is we begin to get a little better, or at least we pay a lot of attention to what the difference might be between that sort of default habitual response that we might not be too happy about and that taking up precepts has something to do. The discouraging news from the former abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, Norman Fisher, in a talk, he said, actually, it just doesn't get any better. You know, so he's been doing it for 40 years. And so again, you still sort of, you know, look at these things sort of rise and fall in your mind, and they're always there, you know. So it's related, I think it's another move on what Piper said last night. I can't remember what we were talking about, but how one of the things in the Cohens we were looking at was like the boundless vows and that they were unfulfillable. So the precepts also were unfulfillable in that sense, and there's endless room for aspiration and failure and getting back up and trying again. I think actually it's terrific that you can't fulfill them, because one of the things that leads to is at some point you kind of give up on the scorecard approach. And I think we really do start with the scorecard approach. You know, it's like, I really want to be a good Buddhist, so, you know, I'm going to give myself, you know, one hit on the wrist for everything of anger or everything of stinginess and so on. And it's just really endless. You know, there's no end to that kind of thing. It's also probably the case that beating up on ourselves that way doesn't really help us get a lot better. And again, as I said, if we watch what rises in our own heart minds and we take it up with the kind of patience and spirit of inquiry and warm curiosity that we take up toward our meditation and toward the actual koans, and also with the spirit of generosity, it's a little more possible that things sometimes, with a lot of backsliding and so on, will begin to shift. If we have some experience of meditation, as Joan says, another thing that may happen, and this certainly happened for us, is I think as we took up the... We actually sat sometimes probably with the precepts as koans. You start to sit with those, I guess, moral prescriptions and proscriptions in some sense in a space that feels really vast. And that really begins to change them. So one of the things that may happen, as Joan liked to say sometimes, is that you can watch them rise and fall in a really big field. I remember a talk of hers where she said that... This is great. She'd been asked by probably Buddha Dharma or some other magazine to respond to a question that was being asked of a lot of teachers. And she said over the years, she'd learned that it was really great to do that because usually what she found out was that she completely disagreed with the premises of the question. You know, so the question was something like, you know, so the purpose of Zen is to get rid of negative emotions. So how does that help? And she sort of scratched her head and said, well, actually, that makes no sense to me at all that the purpose of Zen is to get rid of negative emotions. That what practice does, again, is we watch them rise and fall in a very big field. It's part of Suzuki's, you know, everything goes as it goes. And as they rise and fall in the vastness, they take their proper proportion. And I think it's sane and it's wise and it's a great relief and it's very calming not to feel like, oh, there's this impulse and your job is to sort of make it, you know, hit it and make it go away. But there it is. It's not gigantic. Sometimes it is, but even if it is, it's in this field where lots of other things are rising and falling. And so that's, I think, the spirit with which we work with the precepts. So to say that we take them in a really big field is also, here we go again, but really briefly this time, maybe to put them in relation to the three kayas. So I want to say just a little bit about that. Zenkei Shibayama, the great Japanese teacher, who is pretty cranky in really wonderful ways. One of the strands that goes through his commentary on the Gateless Gate, it's kind of a rant. He says, well, you know, so people say that this koan is about a certain ethical, it's about an ethical assertion. And he says, if it were only about ethics, it wouldn't be a koan at all. And koans are not really about ethics, but they come from and take you to the place from which ethical impulses arise. So the idea would be that they take you to this vast space out of which true ethics might grow. Right. And I hope you can feel, I don't want to go through all this, you know, sort of marking, you know, a multiple choice test, but I hope you can feel in the Dogen especially that sense that the Dharmakaya really comes in and the Sambhogakaya comes in, and that really adds something to the strangeness of those moments in the commentary. And I think the wager is that bringing in the Dharmakaya vantage to your ethical life or the Sambhogakaya vantage can really soften and sometimes dissolve some of the knots of that sort of, you know, billiard ball clashing of the Nirmanakaya. So I want to give a couple of examples from various sources of things like that. So Norman Fisher, who I've already mentioned in a really wonderful book, I'm going to get part of the title wrong, but it's called Training in Compassion, and I think it's Zen Commentaries, but it may be Zen something else, on the Tibetan practice of Lojong. And as part of that, he talks about bodhicitta, the awakening of the heart-mind to the aspiration to attain Buddhahood for the sake of all beings, as Joan defines it. And in one chapter, he distinguishes between what he calls absolute bodhicitta and relative bodhicitta. So absolute bodhicitta would be that impulse, right, to the aspiration to attain Buddhahood for the sake of all beings, seen in relation to the Dharmakaya. And from the vantage of the Dharmakaya, no beings need saving, no beings need help. Everything is already radiant, eternal, serene, and so on. So you could think, okay, it's time to wash my hands and go home, you know, nobody needs any help. And then he talks about relative bodhicitta, which is taking the same kind of thing from the point of view of the Nirmanakaya, where there's tremendous suffering, and the Sambhogakaya, where all that suffering is in some sense, coming from beings who are intertwined with myself. And I think the way the practice works, at least as Norman talks about it, and it makes a lot of sense to me, is that if you also have that Dharmakaya vantage, it gives you the buoyancy and the serenity and the optimism to maybe then step in with a good heart and actually help on the Nirmanakaya level. So there's that. Another one that I love, and this is actually, one or two people have mentioned this to me, but it must ring a bell in me because I keep pretending that everybody mentions it all the time. So in Hakuin, in the sutra service, there's that moment with what you gain from one sitting, all your crimes are wiped away. And I have had one or two people come to me, not at the retreat, but back in town, in work in the room, and just start venting about that, you know, with what you gain from just one sitting, all your crimes away. And it seems really preposterous, you know. I think from the Dharmakaya vantage, it's true that you sit down with whatever you've done in that vastness, and it really is washed away in some sense. And then, just like with what Norman said, rather than saying, okay, you know, the slate is clean, there's something about that maybe enables you to say, now I can make amends. You know, from the point of view of the vastness where it's no crime at all, what about the world of the Nirmanakaya where I've done incredible damage? And again, maybe it gives you something like the serenity or the largeness of scale to actually step in and do what you can to make reparations or amends. So I want to talk a little bit about the Sambhogakaya impinging on the Nirmanakaya, that sense, and I won't take time to do this, but there's some beautiful things that Suzuki Roshi has to say about that. But that sense when, you know, again, if not sort of righteous anger, but that sort of habitual crankiness, so maybe one of your kids comes at you early in the morning and they're being really boingy or something like that, and you realize that you're really irritated. So the third ancestor, Sungsan, in Faith in Mind, says that when discriminating judgments like that arise, just say, not to, and that's T-W-O. It's not to, you know, not don't do it, but not to. Over the years, I've come back to a related practice that worked for me. I just returned to it recently. The not to can feel a little abstract and a little brittle sometimes. So sometimes I'll say, like, if it's my son, Jake, let's say, you know, I'll say, here comes Tanya as Jake, you know, or here comes Tanya as Linda, whatever it is. And it really softens it. You know, there's that. I think often, you know, when somebody irritates us, it's because they're doing something that we also see in ourselves. So that's maybe part of why it works. But it's that, just that little specific kind of phrase allows me to see it in that context and maybe change it a little. So I've been suggesting already that taking up the precepts as koans, even though it involves a turning inward and a spirit of inquiry that might strike somebody as navel-gazing, actually is of real utility as we turn actually back outward to the realm in which we relate to other actual people. I was listening to another talk by John a while ago, and I can't remember when the talk was given, and it's reasonably likely that the person who said this is in the room, though I couldn't recognize the voice. But they were talking about sort of, not the precepts exactly, but things like that, about how we treat one another. And the student said, oh, so the deal would be, instead of asking, how am I doing, I should ask, how are we doing? You know, and that John liked that, it really rang a bell. And I think, again, that giving up the scorecard approach makes that a lot easier to do. If you're constantly asking, you know, am I being a bad person by having this reaction, that's going to be hard to do. But if you have that spirit of inquiry about it, then the how are we doing will be more likely to arise. And I think if you already have, and this is takes some work, you know, but a sense of warm curiosity and patience and also some humor about your own inner life, and if you're trying to fulfill unfulfillable precepts, a quotient of humor would probably be a good thing to bring to the party, right? Maybe you can have something like that feeling as things rise and fall in a very big field that involves both you and the other person and involves not only your feelings, but your surmises, which could certainly not be true, but might be true about what's going on with the other person as well. And there's that sense again that if you let them fall into the vastness for a minute, that, you know, something may shift a little, and the point where you're stuck sometimes will come unstuck. In terms of technique, I think one of the things that you can do, and I don't know about you, but I can be pretty obsessive, you know, so that thing about, oh, I got pissed off and I shouldn't have gotten pissed off. So John talks about that as sort of retreating to the second order. Instead of being in the conversation with somebody else, you're just in relation to you're being pissed off. If you have the relation to your own pissed offness as a meditation practice, you can turn it into a sidebar. You can sort of say, oh, I'll put that on the shelf. That's interesting that I got pissed off. It's sort of a habitual thing in me, or there's something in this other person that's triggering it. So, you know, let me look at that later. And now I can jump back, as John says, to the moment before and try again. So that kind of obsessive, you know, focus on grading your own inner life, you know, you can kind of put to the side, okay? And as that happens and you enter a space, something like the vastness of the various kayas, maybe something can begin to shift a little bit. I think also that the precepts taken up as a kind of koan inquiry restores a sense of mystery to your own inner life, and it can restore a similar sense of mystery to your relations to other people. So if we enter the ethical realm in that frame of mind, we could say, I am not certain. We could say, I'm not knowing is most intimate. And we could say with Keats, when he's talking about negative capability, that we might have the ability to remain in the midst of doubts, mysteries, and uncertainties without any irritable reaching after fact or reason. And if your own inner life is a mystery to you, it seems fine that you may be more able to regard take account of the mysteriousness of what's going on in your relation to somebody else as well. And I think it's more likely maybe that the kind of model you have where you think you know exactly what the other person's thinking and feeling and doing and why they're doing it, you begin to call that into question and you're not so sure about it. And a lot of times, at least in my recent experience, it turns out to be just dead wrong. You know, you have this view of why this person's been doing this for 5 years to you and you just didn't get it right at all. I think also that in some way, beginning to get more familiar with watching your own feelings rise and fall enables you to watch your own models for why things are the way they are, why somebody else is doing something to rise and fall. And I think it's a two-way street. Because if you're committed, if you're stuck on certain feelings, you're likely to be stuck on certain models. But I also find for myself that once I've bought into the model, I'm going to be stuck on the feeling that the model implies. And a lot of times the model was just really inaccurate. So, almost done, but one thing that interests me, and this is the bonus card that you get for doing this sometimes, that moment where Wittgenstein says, a picture held us captive, and the moment where a picture that you have of something falls away can open up the ethical and interpersonal possibilities in a moment like that. There's a weird thing, though, that it has a great deal to do with awakening, that all of a sudden, the model you had of something, it just goes poof, and it's like the bottom drops out of the bucket, and there you are in this unknown space. So I'll tell a little story on myself, just a kind of a small example, and then a tiny awakening, you know, so it's not like a big story. But I was sitting in one of the retreats at Zen Desert Sangha when John Tarrant was still coming down. And John was a little fierce and scary, and he was doing morning greeting the way we do every morning. And as he walked by me, I could feel myself sort of clenching, and I say, he knows I'm in the wrong state of mind. You know, he's really critical. My sitting is really, my retreat is totally messed up, you know. And later he said, of course, I talked to him about it. I said, that's not what I feel at all. I feel a lot of gratitude for the people I'm sitting with. But it didn't wait for that. I was sitting there, and all of a sudden, somebody in my life had told me that I was defensive. And I said, of course I'm not defensive. But I had this moment where it occurred to me that it was entirely likely that John was not thinking that at all, you know. And everything just fell away, and about the next 8 hours were completely radiant. You know, it wasn't like a big Kensho or something, but it was like, you know, Dharmakaya from wall to wall. And it's really strange that just, oh, John thought I was being defensive, or maybe he didn't, would cause an opening like that. But there is this odd thing about Zen practice where little tiny shifts can sometimes provoke kind of big things. And then just to end on a silly note, and then I really am done. When we were in the precepts group, we decided that not all of the precepts, but about 4 or 5 of them could be subsumed under this sort of mega precept, which was, I vow to be interruptible. So, thank you. So over to everybody. We do have a bunch of time. So. It's a time to talk about your own experience of the precepts of taking refuge, to engage anything in the talk if you want to, but certainly not only that. So.
Well, one thing that, as you were describing that, I mean, I just remember looking at the list. I can't remember how I